Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
Well, you said that so seductively.
Sexy. Hi. Might be having a little cold. Maybe that's why.
So, all right, let me get the positive out of the way.
Well, tell me.
Out of the way, but the good news
yeah.
for Mr. Prowler, my kitty cat. So we started the chemo yesterday, and he tolerated it really well, oral chemo. Mm-hmm. And we were, you know, watchful for nausea and all that. He was perkier than all perky. He ate a whole bunch of food, like four times the amount he usually does. He was perky at night. And then, of course, at 5 o'clock in the morning, he decides to throw up on the bed.
Oh.
On the comforter, on the sheets. So I was washing all the bedding this morning. But then he was hungry 2 hours later, and he didn't get the chemo today. Today's just the other medicine
exactly.
and the herbs. And he
what
ate
champ.
Four cans of Fancy Feast this
Unbelievable.
Morning.
You need to buy stock in that stuff.
I know.
That should be our sponsor, Fancy Feast.
I need to find a half-off sale.
Oh, my God.
This stuff is expensive.
Well, it's so funny because I always used to love those commercials and, like, the
so
little,
cute.
You know, the ads. Like, I loved it. It was always, like, the Regal cats. And, like, it was just so cute. So I could just imagine him.
But the most exciting thing is we found a woman vet who
yeah.
is going to come to the house and do acupuncture with mm-hmm. him and laser acupuncture and teach us acupressure. And she's going to do some of his
Perfect.
Vitamin injections. He's holistic. So she's trained in both Eastern and Western philosophies. And I'm just like, she's a godsend. I'm so
Love
excited.
It.
Yay.
Perfect.
Yay.
Perfect.
All right. What up?
So, okay, can we talk about Impractical Jokers this weekend?
I don't think we can help but talk about it because you're here.
Oh, I'm so excited. So, last week we had on the Impractical Joker star and author James Murray. And he was talking about his new scientific book, Awakened. But the big
scientific,
mouth that I am.
You mean sci-fi.
I'm sorry.
The scientist we have on today.
Exactly. Sci-fi. But the big mouth in me was like, oh my gosh, Murr, please, can you get us tickets to your show? Because they're doing a tour and they were coming to LA. And he said, yes. So he got us 5 total tickets. And we had an absolute blast. And I just have to give a shout out. He is such a wonderful person. Like, not only is he hilarious as a comedian, but just a really sweet soul. He really did everything for us. I mean, got us the meet and greet, got us the tickets.
It was so sweet. They had some good, you don't need the tacos.
I know, but David loved it too.
They were great.
Ugh.
All the fixings. And
yes,
the,
everything.
The bar, it was great.
Yeah.
And your son.
Oh, my
your
God.
Your son who conned you. Do you have any boundaries with your child?
Not really.
No. You're calling me. He really wants to go. He really wants to go. He has to go. I'm like,
yep.
It's up to you.
I know.
But
you know what? I'm
like...
glad he went. Okay, yes, okay. He was miserable. Let's just throw it out there because...
Appearing miserable, but apparently he wasn't.
I think he really had a good time. He's just not big into crowds. He gets... And it's loud, and he doesn't like loud noises, and so...
I hate crowds. I never go to those things for that reason. It's hard.
Yeah. No, I'm realizing that a lot of people get really freaked out with that kind of stuff. So, but he really had a good time, and he loves the show, and I think it was a great experience for him. And it was also good for him to realize, like, look, next time you may not love it, like, just so you know.
Now he knows. He's got that in his back pocket to draw from, right?
Yes.
Say, let me remind you that.
Exactly.
What it felt like.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so before we get to our current guest, I have to tell you a really funny story this morning.
Okay.
So I went to Pilates, and then there was enough time for me to be able to take a little walk. Well, historically, in the last 6 months or so, there are these dogs in the neighborhood that get out, right? But apparently they're selling the house, and I haven't seen the dogs. But since then, my neighbor had given me some mace. So I now carry the mace, particularly when I'm walking in the neighborhood by myself, right? So I just was going to do a 30-minute walk. So I'm going on my neighborhood. And I walk past what looks like a quarter, but a very dirty quarter.
Okay.
Right? So I lean down to pick it up or see what it is, and the mace goes off in my pocket.
No.
And I'm like, holy shit. If this stuff is supposed to hurt people, it's like going to be all over my skin.
Oh.
And I'm like, now, literally, I'm holding my pants out where the pocket is, where it's there. I've got nothing to wipe it off with. It's partly on my phone, and I'm like, B, beelining, just running toward home. I have to strip down, get this stuff off because it started to burn my leg, like literally like a red, like I had like a sunburn instantaneously. I'm like, oh my God.
Just for a quarter. Was it worth the quarter?
Quarter?
Yeah, exactly.
It is. I mean, thankfully it didn't get in my
Doesn't it have like a safety button on
that
thing?
Yeah, but I turn it off because you imagine the two dogs running after me and I'm gonna have the wherewithal to pull the shit out and take off the safety?
It. Yeah, I get it. That is hilarious. So well, at least we know it works. Yes. It's legit. It
yes. Oh. So the burn isn't too bad, but it sure wasn't worth right. I never even got the quarter.
I was just going to say.
It went off before I even got my hand down on the ground.
Oh, that's great.
That is funny. All right. So do you want to do the honors or
you
shall I?
Go for it.
All right. Today's guest is Sharon Begley, the author of Can't Just Stop, An Investigation of Compulsions. Sharon Begley is a senior science writer at STAT, the life science publication of the Boston Globe. Previously, she was the senior health and science correspondent at Rutters, the science editor and science columnist at Newsweek, and the science columnist at Wall Street Journal. How impressive, right? Mm-hmm. So in addition to her current book, Can't Just Stop, she's also the author of The Emotional Life of Your Brain and the book Train Your Mind, Change Your Brain, and a co-author with the book with Jeff Schwartz, The Mind and the Brain. Lots of brain stuff. Yeah. Boy, I love this. She's the recipient of numerous awards for her writing, including an honorary degree from the University of North Carolina. An honorary degree. Very rarely ever meet people with that. Okay, So without further ado, welcome Sharon.
Thank you, Dr. Deborah. Great to be with you.
Oh, great to be with you, too. Well, this is a topic that I could not wait for because I'm going to absolutely launch in to first we'll give you the honor of talking about your book and then I'm going to share. I'm so impatient. I want to share my own personal compulsion.
Yes.
So yes, go ahead. No, share your compulsion. Share.
Okay, here you go. So as Kelly knows this, we've had psychics on the show. We've had this. I have some fear in me that is getting increasing as I get older that at some other life I burnt down a house. And I've always had like a thing about the stove because I do have my animals at home and I don't have any compulsions anywhere else. It's not like I have to do counting rituals or crossing things or hand washing or anything, but I literally cannot leave my house without going back and checking the stove, even when I know I didn't use the stove that morning.
Interesting.
And I have to go back. I walk out the door and it's getting worse. It's like almost becoming more rigidified. I get more nervous. I try to just grab myself and go, just go. You know you did it. Mm-hmm. I say it in my head. I visualize it. I put my hand over the stove. But it's really starting to bother me. So any input would be greatly appreciated.
Well, that's a classic one, but usually without the past lives part of it. what you're describing, is a form of obsessive compulsive disorder, which is probably the best known and best studied of the compulsive behaviors. And you used a few words in there that really underline what's going on with compulsions, what underlies them. You talked about being bothered. And the reason I emphasize that is, so one of the big mysteries that I faced when I started to do the reporting for the book was just, what is a compulsion? Compared to like what is an addictive behavior. So we can get to that in a second. But the bottom line is a compulsion is driven by anxiety. And in your case, you feel, as you just described, very anxious that maybe you've left the stove on, maybe something else. You didn't mention candles, but anything that could start a fire, and that you can't move on. You can't leave the house until you have checked and checked and checked again. Because otherwise, if you're like the people I spoke to for the book, the anxiety is just overwhelming. It's like burning a hole in your brain. You just cannot move on because of it. So again, apart from the past lives part, you're describing something that's really a classic.
Okay, so now, can you give me some suggestions on what I do about that? Because I'm trying to pause and really like do a visualization and such, but it seems like I have to do this. Like I leave the house, I put my things in the car, and then I go back, and sometimes it's twice and sometimes it's once. But I get fearful that what about in a year from now? What if it's going to be 10 times? What if I get to that place and my anxiety becomes more anxiety ridden, then now I'm never going to be able to leave the house?
Right. And, that's very important to emphasize that it can be life transforming. It can absolutely wreck your life. And I just wanted to throw that in because in pop culture, you know, some depictions of OCD in TV and movies and whatever, it's sort of held up for ridicule. Oh, isn't this funny that, you know, this person has to straighten magazines or he has to keep checking to see if he turned off the stove or locked the front door, whatever. And as you just said, it is really not funny because I spoke to people who not only do they have the checking compulsion, but maybe they have a compulsion that when they are driving and they feel even a little sort of shaking under the car, they're convinced that they ran over a pedestrian.
Oh.
They have to stop. They have to go back. Oh. They have to look around and assure themselves that they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then they try to proceed, but they can't. They have to go back again because they tell themselves, oh, gosh, I didn't see anyone lying in the road, but maybe, you know, I threw them off to the side and they're lying in the ditch or whatever. So it's not funny. It can be, it can really just ruin your life. So to your question about what can be done about it, I definitely want to hear Therapist Kelly's views on this, but because what you described is, as I say, a classic OCD symptom, and OCD is the most studied of the compulsions, what has been shown to work for some people, we can talk about medications if you want, but let me just talk about therapy. One form of cognitive behavior therapy seems to be effective, and you guys have talked about CBT a lot,
sure.
So I'll just give you the, you know, the few second version of it. You practice telling yourself that this feeling that you have, this anxiety that the stove is still on, that the house is going to burn down, is just an aberrant signal from your brain. Your brain is sending you a misleading message. It's basically a lie. Because, in fact, research has shown exactly where that error message from the brain comes from. So, again, it doesn't work for everybody, but there have been a bunch of studies showing that when people go through CBT of this kind and learn to say, oh, this is a misleading, a incorrect message from my brain, I know that I can overcome it and not believe it. So obviously, as I say that, I make it sound a lot easier than it really is. It really is a struggle for people. But again, all I can say is that studies have shown that for a large fraction of people with exactly what is described, it is effective.
I love that. I really like that.
Well, I got to tell you, instantaneously, my brain went to an argument because my brain instantly said, well, you haven't seen the couple of times in my history that I have left the stove on.
Uh-huh.
So therefore, it is possible. It's not crazy, and it has happened. I think the difference, though, that I have to continue to remind myself is that's usually if I've been in a flurry of, like, flooded with things overwhelming me, having to do all this stuff and just, like, race out, not when I'm just cautiously just, like, you think most people do a spot check in their house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, door locked, stove off, okay, gotta go. But they don't have to get stuck in that process of not being able to go after knowing that they just did that. So I think that's what you're describing, Sharon?
Do the spot check, but don't get stuck. Don't go back and back and back and back. You know, just train your brain to believe the evidence of your eyes.
Mm, I like that too.
Ah, so, the evidence of my eyes. I like that. Except I'm blind. No, I'm kidding.
I have a question. So are those little compulsions, are they driven in general by anxiety? Like, in other words, is it fair to say that sort of the umbrella term that Dr. Deborah has and other people have is basic anxiety, but it's kind of funneling into this particular compulsion?
Yes. That's the short answer. So let's again take OCD because it's the best studied. The anxiety comes from a feeling that something is wrong. Again, in Dr. Deborah's example, you left the stove on, but it can also be I ran over somebody. It can be a little bit less connected to facts, like if I step on a crack, someone I love will die. It can be I left the front door open. It can be, and a very common form of OCD is my hands are covered with germs and I will get some horrible illness unless I wash them and wash them and wash them again. People will wash their hands hundreds of times a day until they are red and bleeding because they are so convinced that they are covered with germs. Again, something is wrong.
Yeah.
And that error message from the brain has been isolated. It comes from a particular region. It's basically overactivity in the worry circuit. And we all have a worry circuit because if we didn't, then, you know, like we wouldn't pay attention to the the shadow up ahead in a doorway when we're walking down a city street, or, you know, we wouldn't pay attention to the barking of a dog that sounds like, you know, it's not happy with us or whatever. So we all have a worry circuit. The difference in OCD is, no, the difference is that it is just on hyperdrive. Mm-hmm. And so all of the therapies that are targeted at OCD are meant to reduce the overactivity in the worry circuit. So again, it does come from anxiety, and the anxiety itself is the result of the feeling that something is wrong. Mm-hmm. And that was really the moment, I would say, when in reporting the book, I finally had my aha realization, because until then, everything, I have to tell you, had been a muddle. And the reason I say that is, so as I mentioned, I start reporting, and the first thing I want to do is figure out what is the difference between a compulsive behavior and an addictive one. People talk about compulsive shopping or an addiction to shopping, compulsive gambling or an addiction to gambling. So are they the same? Are we just throwing around words here without any, formal scientific underpinning? And again, the big difference is that a compulsion is born in anxiety, and an addiction, which is not what the book is about, but just let me throw it out there, is born from a what I call a hedonic hit, a feeling that something is really, really pleasurable. Mm. So if you get an intense pleasure from something you do and you can't stop doing it and you do it too much, that's probably a behavioral addiction. But Dr. Deborah, I would venture to say that you do not get pleasure from checking and checking and checking the stove. No. I mean, the closest thing it comes to pleasure probably is like, if you stop banging your head against a brick wall, yeah, that feels pretty good. But it's not pleasure in the way that most of us understand the term. So that's why it's a compulsion and not an addiction.
Okay. I like that definition.
Yeah, me too. Now, I don't think, though, I would qualify. I haven't looked at the DSM-5 in a while for a full OCD diagnosis, since it is very specific to this mm-hmm. one particular event. And if somebody else is in the house and I can entrust somebody else to do the check for me, and I won't go back in.
Oh, that's good. So you can delegate.
Yeah, but it drives Christopher crazy.
That is good. Well, but you put your finger on another very important thing here, which is that, all of our behaviors exist along a continuum. Mm-hmm. There is just paralyzing OCD. People cannot leave the house. They cannot stop washing their hands. They can't work. They can't interact mm-hmm. with people. They can't go to school. They just cannot function. Mm-hmm. And then there is mild OCD, where, you just have to check a time or two. And then there's behavior that, as you said, for the DSM-5, does not even qualify for a diagnosis. But people can still have a compulsion without having a mental disorder. And that's really one of the main points I hope people come away with from the book, mm-hmm. the idea that just because you have a compulsion does not mean that your brain is broken. Mm-hmm. It can be working in an absolutely fine way, maybe a little bit toward, one extreme on the continuum, but it's very likely reacting to just, the way we all have to live and think and feel. So one of the things I tried to do in the book was not normalize pathologies, but sort of demedicalize behaviors that I think have been over-pathologized.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great statement. Now, Kelly, you be the focal point. I just...
So my compulsion, well, it's so funny because as you're talking, I'm like, oh, God, this might mean I'm addicted to shopping, because I definitely get a hit when I shop. I mean, Deborah knows I'm a shopper.
She's a shopper.
I love shopping. Like, even it was so funny because my husband said to me, he's like, Kelly, we're having some money stuff. You got to, necessities only. And so I had to go to the mall to meet somebody, and it was literally like a movie scene. Like, I felt like I was walking past the store and I'm like gripping on, to like walls. I'm like, oh, I just want to go in. I want to look. And then like I'd be okay. And then I'd pass another store. I'm like, oh, but those shoes, they're so cute. And then I kind of like start rationalizing it. Oh, but they're probably not that much money. And I kind of, go through the whole scenario in my head. But so I definitely have a little shopping addiction. But my main thing that I'm so curious, because I know, my guess would be a huge part of society has this, is the social media compulsivity, just sort of having to check the email and sort of getting that dopamine hit when you see that you've got a couple messages and that whole thing. So I'd love your thoughts about that, Sharon.
Yes. So So that was one of the most fun chapters that I did in the book. This goes back to the point a second ago, that just because you have a compulsion doesn't mean that your brain is broken. And digital compulsions, whether it's, you know, checking your Twitter feed or your Facebook, what your friends have posted on Facebook, just, you know, whatever it happens to be, is a great example of that. And the reason I say that is digital media, going back to the days of email, but certainly, you know, more contemporary ones, have a quality that's called variable intermittent reinforcement, which is basically your Las Vegas slot machine. Big words, but basically what it means is you don't know when you'll get a reward, and you don't know how big the reward will be. So what does that mean when it comes to, you know, let's keep it to, you know, texting or something. You know, your friends are texting you all the time, and most of it is, you know, dare I say, not that interesting. Maybe your friends are more interesting than mine, but most of the stuff that I get, you know, frankly, I could have lived without probably for a really long time and maybe forever. same with, you know, Facebook posts. Oh, you know, Nancy has a new Facebook picture or Nancy, whatever. Mm-hmm. Most of it you really, really don't need to check, and you certainly don't need, you know, at that second. But occasionally there is some amazing thing that you are really, really glad you looked at exactly then. You know, maybe it's somebody, you know, was hurt, some family emergency, or just, you know, we're meeting for beers. Can you come right now? And because of that payoff structure, as it's called, again, it's called variable intermittent, if you resist checking, this goes back to anxiety. You, and I'm generalizing here, sure, but many people are filled with anxiety because they worry, what might I be missing? And that's why we have to keep looking and looking and checking, and we can't take our eyes away from the screen.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like it could easily be both a compulsion and an addiction, right? Because the addiction part is that, wow, when I do get the likes on my Facebook, people are mm-hmm. responding, commenting. Wow, that's a powerful
yep.
mood enhancer. And,
yes.
and at
yes.
the same
you
time,
absolutely
though, but not being able to
stop. Dopamine hit. Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. So that's why it's, you know, especially powerful. But there's something else that, you know, whoever is, you know, creating video games and who structured all social media and everything else, it has figured out, which is that, again, we do a lot of this stuff to escape anxiety. And let me just quote one brief study for you. People just cannot be physically apart from their smartphones these days. And something like 70% of people say that smartphones and texting help them overcome anxiety and other negative moods. You know, we've all probably seen it, that, you know, you go to a party or any other awkward situation, so many people just have their faces on their screens because, again, it's a way to dissipate anxiety.
Yes.
But something else is going on these days. So there was another study in which people were asked to give up. They had a choice. They could either give up their smartphones and, you know, not look at stuff for about an hour, or they could feel an electric shock. Not, you know, not strong. We're not talking about tasers here. But, you know, an electric shock that you could definitely feel uncomfortable with. And a large fraction said, no, give me the shock. I don't want to be away from my phone
wow.
for even
scary.
A few minutes.
Frightening.
So, I've read that, too.
You know, that's where we are these days.
Oh.
First of all, I would totally give up my phone. I don't want
a shock.
I thought
you were going to say you would totally
no,
want the shock.
No, that to me is so unappealing. Oh,
you
my
know,
God.
Though, I would want the shock just for curiosity. Not because like, I couldn't give up my phone. I'd say, have my phone, but I want to feel what that feels
right,
like.
Right.
Remember those Milgram studies where they shock people to see how much they would comply?
Yes.
Milgram? Who are they?
I know what you're talking about. It's so scary. But, okay, so do you feel like, Sharon, it's this idea of I'm missing out, it's this idea of I feel important because I feel connected, like what is the, or do you think it's based on I'm anxious if I don't know what's going on?
There's a whole new thing, right? FOMO, fear of missing out,
yeah.
That absolutely has overtaken so many people. So let me just, you know, read to you a couple of things that people said when they were apart from their phone. The fact that I was not able to communicate with anyone via technology was almost unbearable. Mm. I feel so disconnected from all the people who I think are calling me.
Uh-huh.
I frantically craved some technology. I couldn't take it anymore. So yes, there's a feel of missing out, a feeling of missing out. There is also that feeling of being disconnected, the feeling that something is going on and you are not part of it, which is getting more and more prevalent, more common, because so many of us now communicate, if not only, then at least largely digitally.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a cliche that younger people, the millennial generation, is much comfortable texting than they are phoning someone, actually using their phone as, you know, a voice communication device. And there's one other thing that I'd like to mention here. Something about the world we live in makes people, it seems, very uncomfortable being alone with their own thoughts. You know, it used to be that you would stand on a line at a bank, at an ATM, whatever, or stand in line to actually buy something at a brick and mortar store. And you sort of, you know, stare into space. If you're with someone, you'd maybe talk to them or whatever. But if you were alone, you would be alone with your own thoughts. And, you know, those thoughts could be anything. But now, people just seem very, very uncomfortable with that. And so, you know, you scroll through your inbox, you constantly check for incoming text, you know, jump from website to website, whatever it happens to be. So I don't know really what that's about, but it seems to be really, really prevalent.
I could see that too. Yeah, well, and I think also it's like, well, wow, I might as well utilize this second to do work. Or, I mean, I can see it both ways. It's like I'm bored and I don't want to sit with my thoughts. And it's also like, okay, well, I can utilize this time to actually get something done, or, you know.
Well, I remember historically sitting around and having a question in my mind and not quite getting able to answer it, but thinking about it and finally coming up with the answer. Now you just flip and ask Siri, hey, when was this? And you get the answer right away. We were just completely taught to have immediate gratification all the time.
Yeah.
So, wow. I can't believe, though, that all came up, that kind of intense response from being away from the smartphone for 1 hour.
Yeah. Again, because people just get really jittery. I mean, it is like withdrawal from something addictive. And, you know, to your point about small units of time, yes. I mean, what else can you do in, you know, the minute or whatever that you're waiting online or something? So it does feel like a good use of time, but it also feels like you are connected. You're not missing out. You know, where it will all lead, who knows? Some people have become so driven to constantly check for, you know, text, email, social media, whatever it happens to be, that it's become debilitating. So a number of cities now have sort of cut the cord, time out from social media, whatever, just a day without, and people are trying to go cold turkey, because if, you know, if it's wrecking your work life, your personal life, your relationships, whatever, then clearly it's become not a coping mechanism and something that's really not good for you.
Well, I'm wondering too, and I'm wondering if you know this connection, if there's more distractibility with people now. I mean, they're so used to, you know, going from website to website and not waiting, and they don't have the patience. And I'm wondering if there's like a you know, a higher rate of like, you know, ADHD or something of that sort.
So that is definitely a big research question. But before we dump all over, you know, hypertext and links and jumping from website to website, let me also remind you guys, as you probably know, Sesame Street, so now we're going back more than 20 years, but some of the earliest Sesame Streets were criticized for increasing children's distractibility and reducing their attention span, because it too had a lot of quick cuts. You know, there was a song, then there was this, then we're going to a letter, then we're going to a number. It wasn't the long, slow kind of, I don't know, Mr. Rogers,
Hobo Kelly
TV show or whatever. Yeah. So I just throw that out to say that popular media has been, you know, criticized for decades for doing all sorts of terrible things to children and our brains and everything else. However, that said, to your point about asking, you know, your digital assistant for, you know, I can't remember who starred in that movie or what was the name of this or whatever. Mm-hmm. Instead of searching our own memories, absolutely, we resort to, you know, an online search, you know, whatever we happen to be using. And there is no question that as you become less practiced in searching your memory, less practiced in figuring out what's connected to what. Like maybe if I'm trying to remember, I don't know, Patrick Swayze, you know, I might think of a movie, then I might think who he was in with it and all this other stuff, and eventually it will lead me to Patrick Swayze, and then maybe I'll remember that he died of cancer. All these things, all these very, very rich connections, these circuits in our brain, if we're not using them anymore, if we're instead just, you know, Googling, you know, whatever we happen to be looking for, those are becoming disused. And the more they become disused, the more it's a, I don't know if self-fulfilling prophecy is the right term, but if we're not using them because it's too much trouble to use them, then they deteriorate and we can't use them. So that, you know, just cannot be a good thing.
That is frightening,
isn't it?
Wow. I know, I'm just dumbfounded.
Yeah,
I was thinking, oh, after the show, I want to go meditate.
Use the brain for good.
I have to tell you though that I mean I'm going to add in as an alternative method to when people will talk about, well, there's, you know, medications and things like that for compulsions, but you know, yoga has helped a lot to just still the mind and listen to the body, and I am just loving it. I think it's helped me to slow down.
I could see that.
So
yeah.
So consumed. And it, also in our line of work, Kelly, I mean, we have our clients almost now expect us to be able to respond right away.
Sure.
Because, you know, they're used to other people doing that. But sometimes, you know, when we're in session, I never respond to texts when I'm in session with someone else. Do you?
No.
No.
Never. Yeah, I don't even have my phone near me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you think there's that expectation of like, come on, get
I
back
do.
To me.
I mean, I've
yeah.
had to tell some patients, you know, most of them are fine. They realize that,
right.
you know, if I'm not talking to them, it's because I'm doing something else.
Yeah.
And I have deserve to do that. But some people really have gotten kind of cranky. It's like, well, I texted you this morning.
Well, yes.
It's only 2 o'clock and I'm in the middle of client after client after client. But I find that with myself too. If I have somebody not respond back to me, now I start to get impatient because our expectations also change.
Absolutely.
Do you find that to be true, Sharon, that our expectations now
absolutely,
of other people?
Yes. We're all being trained to have, you know, instant answers. And if you, you know, have the audacity to not have your phone on at all times, practically, then, you know, people take it as a personal affront or something. And so that gets back to the anxiety part. I mean, are we keeping our phones on? Are we constantly checking because we love it, because it's so much fun? Or, you know, I would say no, because it feels like a drag. But we also know that, you know, to your point, Deborah, that if we don't respond instantly, somebody's going to be mad at us. And if it's our boss, that, you know, being mad at can have, you know, significant real world consequences.
Right.
So again, it's anxiety. And that's what makes it a compulsion.
I think this is where having kept some sort of a landline is a really good thing, but it's very expensive for people, because at least with a landline you can turn your smartphone off.
Yes.
And then you just, the people who, you know, your family or somebody, if something were to happen, they could get a hold of you. Because I mean, I realized that when my father was sick and went to the hospital, and when he passed, I was the point of contact. If I didn't have my cell phone on, there was no way that anybody would reach me, and I wouldn't have known.
Right.
So there's certainly times when it's so appreciated to have that, but other times where it's like, ah! Yeah.
I usually turn my phone on, you know this, at like 7:30.
Yeah, you're done.
I'm done. That's my time to like get off the phone and just watch TV and tuck my kids in and
but
be done.
But you're up sending text messages and emails at 5 in the morning.
5 in the morning, so it comes back
to
haunt
you. That big of a gold medal there, Chicky.
But I don't wake you up, by the way, do I? If at like 5?
No, I am now. I do turn my phone off in the middle of the night, but I do have it with some anxiety. So our answer to that is we got what's called the bat phone. We have another phone that only certain select people in our family
that's
have
smart.
The answer to, like our kids, even though they're all grown, but just, you know,
sure.
That's
smart. That's, we have a landline. Yeah.
Yeah.
Same.
You have a landline. Right.
Yeah. I think you got to put boundaries around it to survive.
Absolutely. We are speaking with Sharon Begley, the author of Can't Just Stop, An Investigation of Compulsion. This is fascinating. I know there's probably more to say about this, but I want to make sure we cover hoarding as well. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So the hoarders I spoke to were probably the ones who really just broke my heart. So let me tell you about, so hoarding, as I was saying earlier about OCD and how it's made fun of in pop culture. There are all these hoarding shows on cable TV, right? You know, just people decluttering and, you know, just the disaster that their homes are, and somebody whips in and, you know, fixes everything or not. So I reached out to a number of hoarders. And Let me just tell you about one of them, just to give you a sense that these are not people to be made fun of, but somebody, people who really are coping as best they can. So this woman's name is Bonnie, and she had a sort of difficult life. She had a number of children, but she also had several miscarriages. Her husband was somewhat abusive. He sort of never gave her what the life that she hoped for. The only presents he ever brought home for her were cardboard boxes that he got at work. She had a lot of dreams, she told me, whether it was, you know, building a lovely gazebo in her backyard or going on vacation with her children. And financially and for other reasons, none of her dreams came true. So slowly over the years, she began saving stuff. She never got rid of the cardboard boxes that her husband brought home because they were the only things he ever gave her. Her children's toys, fancy dishes that she used only for special occasions, mountains and mountains of magazines and newspapers because they would have clippings or they would have stories about some wonderful place that she hoped to visit one day or mm-hmm. some wonderful home improvement project that she wanted to do. And, you know, she set aside many of the things that she liked for her children, for her husband, and she thought, someday I'll read that book, and someday I'll get back to knitting. So she saved all the books, and she saved all the knitting materials. So the boxes filled up, and the yarns and the needles and the books, you know, started to make piles in her room. And it got really, really bad, so much so that the local building inspector threatened to condemn her house. Mm. So I was asking her, you know, wasn't that motivation enough to just declutter, to get rid of stuff? And again, I should have said at the top when we first started talking, I'm so indebted to the people who have one or another compulsion for talking to me and for really opening up their minds and hearts to me.
Sure.
And Bonnie is one of them. So anyway, as I was asking her, you know, does she think was going on? And she said, she thinks the problem is that she dreamed. She had a dream that her life would be nice, that she'd go on vacation, or she'd have a beautiful garden or a pretty room like she saw in magazines. But her husband never made a lot of money. It didn't work out. So instead of having the things she dreamed about, or instead of going on vacation, she became attached to the pieces of paper and the boxes and all the other stuff. And now all she has is that, and she just cannot give it up. It would be like ripping out her heart to give it up.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the more extreme stories that people told me. But hoarders, one of the things that characterizes them is that they are deeply, deeply sentimentally attached to a lot of stuff, much more stuff than people who don't have a hoarding problem are. And let me just, you know, make another pitch for my point that we exist, human behavior exists along a continuum. Hoarders have an extreme version of what I would dare say, you know, we all have. I mean, if you told me that I had to throw away, you know, whatever, the macaroni art that my children brought home from first grade, you know, no way.
Yeah.
One of the things that I hoard, and I should say right here that if you walked into my house, you would think this woman does not have any possessions. I have nothing. But one of the things I have kept for forever are the dried flowers from my mother's funeral. So I'm not getting rid of those. I'm not parting with those. People who hoard just have that sentimental attachment to way more stuff than you and I do, but they are not that fundamentally different. And I just, again, one of the things I hope people take away from the book is just a little bit more sympathy for people who really are very much like the rest of us.
Sure. Of course, yeah. Mm. I've always liked the continuum concept of everything, because all of us have some ability to empathize mm-hmm. with people if we just put it in a framework that we can identify.
Sure. Well, and I remember hearing also that a lot of hoarders, a lot of times there's like a death that they're holding on to, or so it sounds like there's something in these possessions that they are holding on to. It symbolizes something else, sounds like, too.
And absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, again, you know, my mother died, but I have the flowers from her funeral. My children are now no longer little teeny little people, but I have, you know, the ridiculous art that they made in elementary school.
Yeah.
So let me give you an example of a form of keeping stuff. I won't call it hoarding, that stops well short of hoarding, but captures the feeling. So you probably know the law professor, Alan Dershowitz. So he is now retired, and because he retired from Harvard Law School, he was, you know, getting rid of stuff, moving, downsizing, whatever. And so he sold to an auctioneer, a collection of Judaica that he had been amassing for like a half a century, you know, menorahs and other things. And he said, it breaks my heart to have to sell it, but I want to, because I want to feel that I'm connected to the past. So as you just said, Kelly, you know, it's a connection. It's these things that have meaning for us. Again, we all have that. People who hoard just imbue more things with more meaning than the rest of us do.
And we promote that in our society, too. We promote memorabilia, right? You go to a sports event, you have to buy the cap. You go here, you have to get a souvenir. So who's to say when does that souvenir run out of its time, right? You're supposed to keep a souvenir for 3 years or for 2 years, and why call it a souvenir? It's something you're supposed to save, right? I mean, it's kind of a little bit crazy-making because we kind of encourage that in people, and then all of a sudden we point the finger and go, how come you have so much stuff? You know, it's like, well, wait a minute, though. My mom and dad said every time we go someplace, and we have to get a souvenir.
Right, and not only you know, memorabilia and collectibles, but just the whole phenomenon of being a collector. So if you are, you know, well-to-do and you have a fancy collection of just some of the examples in the book, 4,000 miniature books, some no bigger than a grain of rice, or, you know, an amazing collection of maps. I spoke to someone who collects objects from the theater world. If that stuff is well organized and if it's not terribly eclectic, in other words, if it's focused on just, I don't know, snow globes or, you know, whatever your passion happens to be, that's okay. And society, you know, finds that charming and even interesting and everything else, right? But, you know, it doesn't take that much to go over in the other direction where you collect too much and it's a mess and all you have where you live are goat paths, which means, you know, just these little aisles between mountains of stuff. You know, it's really there, but for the grace of God, could so many of us go.
Yeah, and I think that just sort of brings us to the psychology component from the DSM-5 and such. For something to be considered a mental disorder or something, it does have to cause you distress and limited functioning in other areas of your life, or negatively affected functioning in other areas of your life. So even some of these people who, you know, are looked upon as hoarders, if they're actually able to do other things and leave the house and go hang out with other people and such, then it's usually not considered as big as a problem as if somebody has become so attached to those things that they literally need to be surrounded by them all the time, or they cannot breathe.
Exactly. And the criteria that you just mentioned, so the DSM-5 is the most recent edition of the American Psychiatric Association's diagnostic manual. When did it come out? I think 2013. And absolutely, the distress and impairment criteria are crucial to a diagnosis of mental disorder, which raises the interesting question. If Bonnie, the lady I was talking about, if she had a huge house and, you know, maybe a maid or something, if she, you know, just had the financial wherewithal to organize her magazines and her boxes and her knitting and her children's toys, you know what? Would she then be considered not afflicted with a mental disorder as she is now, but just sort of, you know, an eccentric somebody, whatever. So, you know, it's really, I mean, that's why psychiatry really has a ways to go, of course, in, you know, becoming empirical, becoming scientific, because there's an awful lot of wiggle room when, you know, people are diagnosed or not diagnosed.
And so we have a few minutes left, but I want to know if you can tell us a little bit about the more unusual compulsions that you've come across.
Good question.
So I came across quite a few. So one is a man in England who was known as the Mole, M-O-L-E, man, because he would dig and dig and dig and dig. He felt compelled to dig these massive, winding, deep tunnels under his house. He lived in East London. They were, gosh, I think it was like 60 feet long, 26 feet under the house. And the reason, he said, was he first tried to dig a wine cellar, and then he thought, well, that went pretty well, I'll dig some more. So he kept digging. And he was asked, why don't you just stop? In fact, his house was eventually condemned because the local authorities thought it would collapse. And he said, I just can't. As long as I know that there's more to dig, I just can't stop, which is one of the reasons why the book is called what it is. Mm-hmm. Another strange one, and this I got from a journal, not from speaking to the person. There's a man who felt compelled to whistle carnival songs, just like the you know, crazy earbud music that you hear at, you know, a state carnival or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he would just whistle it for, you know, endlessly throughout the day, five to 8 hours every day. Oh. And it would get worse when he was tired and this and that. So again, he was asked, why can't you just stop? And he said that if he were asked to stop, he just became really, really anxious. So as I said, I didn't talk to him. I didn't get a chance to ask, you know, what did you worry would happen, mm-hmm. If you stopped? But he did say, he did, you know, utter the magic word, anxious. So, you know, our feelings of anxiety can come out in all sorts of very strange ways.
Yes. That's the also trichotillomania. Mm-hmm. It's a form of a compulsion, right? I think it qualifies as that. That's hair pulling out.
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. Hair pulling. I spoke to a young woman who did that. You know, she and others who have that feel very, very ashamed of what they do. They feel they can't go out in public. And it's not really clear what that comes from, but she described it to me as, if I'm not pulling out my hair, and it's not just the head hair, that's why it can become
eyebrows,
right? Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I feel that there's just too much on me, and it makes my skin crawl to know that there is all this hair on me. Mm-hmm. So, again, a very debilitating disorder, because, you know, your appearance changes,
yes.
And it's very hard to operate in the world.
Yeah, there was this young lady in my middle school who, I guess someone told her if she pulled out all of her eyelashes, they would grow back thicker,
yes.
And lusher. Oh. So she had all this anxiety that her eyelashes weren't pretty enough. So she did that, and then it turned into a compulsion. And once, even though it was clear they were not going to grow back in the way that she was told, she just then started to move to other areas of her body. It was really sad. I, of course, was in middle school. I had no idea what that was
right.
at the time. Trying to help her, but... Hopefully she got out of that. Yeah, it's nice that we are talking about this from such a compassionate place. Well, I hope people are hearing that.
And that's what I love about you, Sharon. Like, this is, like, I love that you have that nurturing heart around it. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, it's true. And it's like, you know, God, I mean, even the way you're describing it, like, my heart hurts because I can't imagine having to live with that on a daily basis, you know, like going back and thinking I've run over somebody or pulling out I mean, nobody likes, you know, to do this. I think, you know, people forget. It's like nobody wants to be in that world.
That's what I think.
Well, I think I have no doubt that it's scientifically true to describe these as being on a continuum of behavior and emotion. To say, as I was with hoarding, that people who have these behaviors, in those cases, are just extreme forms of the rest of us. But really, what I hope people come away from the book with, in addition to greater understanding of others, is also an understanding maybe of why they engage in whatever compulsions they do, mm-hmm. probably falling well short of a diagnosable disorder, but just, you know, whatever the disorder, whatever the compulsion happens to be. Because if you use the lens that I hope I've provided, I think you can look inside yourself and figure out why you're doing what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have been such a wonderful guest.
Thank you so much.
So again, we've been talking with Sharon. Is it Begley or Beagley? We want to make sure that I'm saying
Begley. You got it right. Yes.
Okay, good. Okay, good.
Good. And we're talking to you about the book Can't Just Stop, An Investigation of Compulsions. Where can people get the book and how can they find you?
I hope it is all at your local bookstore, but also at your favorite online bookstore. And I myself have a little website that my children built for me at SharonLBegley.com.
Awesome.
Beautiful.
Thank you so much. So interesting. Really, really appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you both. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Such good insights.
Oh my gosh. So
and so rare to have somebody write about this who isn't actually in our field.
I was thinking that,
really,
which is good. You get like an objective
journalist
style. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Well, you have to report back if you utilize what she said about the stove and see what happens.
I'm going to try it.
Yeah.
You betcha. Next week is also very exciting. You like landed this one for us. We have Dr. John and Julie Gottman.
Yes.
They are very huge in our field.
Psychology. Oh, it's going to be awesome. Can't wait. Nice.
Okay, everybody, have a great week. Prayers for Prowler, please.
Yes, we will.
And for anybody else out there who has anybody suffering or
hurting,
well, prayers for you,
it
too.
It is a show of compassion. And now the self-plug.
Okay, find us. Do it. Find us on
Instagram, Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly. And we have a Facebook page, Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly. And you can send us emails anytime if you have something to say at Dr. Deborah.
What is nope, doc and therapist.
Doc and therapist.
Doc and therapist at gmail.com.
Yeah, exactly. I was trying to do it by memorization. All right. Well, have a great rest of your week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.